Wow, what a crowd.
You're right, this is tough. Yeah,
Good afternoon, I'm Charlie Kravitz, General Manager of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Yay! WBUR is very proud to be the presenting partner of the Boston Book Festival. You'll have to excuse me, I'm suffering from a cold, as many of us are. So I'm personally delighted to be here with you to introduce this conversation with one of the great historians of our time. Before we begin, I do have some unfortunate news to share with you. Because of a personal situation, Tom Ashbrook is unable to be here today. He is very sorry to miss this event, but his news analysis for analyst for On Point, Jack Beatty, has graciously agreed to step in. Thank you, Jack. Thank you. Jack Beatty is the author of The Rascal King, The Life and Times of James Michael Curley, The World According, excuse me, to Peter Drucker, Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900, and The Lost History of 1914, How the Great War Was Not Inevitable. He helped Mayor Thomas Menino write his political memoir, Mayor for a New America, published last week. We are so pleased, as we are every Friday on Point, to have him with us here today. Jack will be interviewing our history keynote speaker after in just a moment, but it's truly a thrill for me to tell you a bit about her first, as she is both a personal friend and a great friend of WBUR. A former White House fellow, Doris Kearns Goodwin worked closely with Lyndon B. Johnson during and after his time as president, and she assisted him in writing his memoirs. Her biography, No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, the home front in World War II, won the 1995 Pulitzer Prize. Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, received the 2005 Lincoln Prize, awarded annually to the best book about the Civil War. And her most recent book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism, has been called, quote, a notable psychologically charged study in leadership. And I'm happy to tell you that Doris will be available and signing books in the main tent outside after this event. So, without further ado, please welcome On Point news analyst Jack Beatty and the award-winning journalist, political commentator, and historian Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Thank you, Charlie.
Well, let me just say, Doris, what a pleasure it is to talk to you. You're not only one of our most esteemed historians and successful authors, but probably one of our best loved ones. So it's just
Thank
a
you.
Great pleasure to be here with you. You know, how I think sort of a foundational question authors get all the time, and one it's hard to answer sometime, maybe you can do it, is how is it you pick your targets, your subjects? And having picked them, how do you choose the angle? For example, it's not obvious that a book about Theodore Roosevelt and the Muckrakers would also be about Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft. So how does that alchemy go on? I mean, can you take us inside the laboratory of your mind?
I would be glad to. I mean, surely the first book that I ever wrote on Lyndon Johnson, it wasn't a question of picking him. In some ways, he picked me, thank God, as an intern, because those last years that I spent with him, when he was so sad and so fearful that his legacy on domestic politics had been overridden by the war in Vietnam, he opened up to me in ways he never would have had I known him at the height of his power. And I think that experience of getting to know one live president made me think, when I went back to these dead presidents, that I wanted to understand them and get inside them and look fairly at them from an inside point of view rather than an outside. But it also meant that I knew from then on that I wanted to choose somebody that I basically wanted to live with, because my books take me so long, I could never live with Hitler or Stalin. The idea of waking up with them every morning and thinking about them when I go to bed at night seems impossible. So the first thing I think about is, who am I going to live with for a period of time? And then the problem is, the people I've chosen, whether it's Lincoln or FDR or Teddy Roosevelt — Lincoln took 10 years, Teddy Roosevelt and Taft took 7 years. The book on Franklin and Eleanor took longer than World War II took to be fought to write. So I can't just write a biography about these people because they happen to be the most popular people that other people have written about. Lincoln, 14,000 books, thousands of books about Teddy, thousands of books about FDR. So even though I've chosen them because they are the most companionable, because the eras in which they live are the ones I want to go back to, I want to live — it sounds crazy to say I want to live in the Civil War — I want to live in those dramatic times of the turn of the 20th century, the Civil War, the New Deal, or World War II, I have to come up with some fresh way, hopefully, that I'm not just repeating what others have done. Mm-hmm. So what that means, and that's my rationale for why these books take so long, is it means that I have to do multiple biographies, not just the one person. So with Franklin, it was not just Franklin, Roosevelt, Franklin and Eleanor. And then I brought the home front in instead of the war front, because there were so many more books written about the war than the home front. True. And then when I got to Lincoln, it was really scary. And for a couple of years, I thought I would do Abe and Mary as I had done Franklin and Eleanor, because I had some confidence that that had worked. But I realized that Mary couldn't carry the public side of the story the same way that Eleanor clearly had been able to. And then luckily I went to Seward, his Secretary of State's home in upstate New York, early in the research, and his home has been in the family forever, and everything was saved. So they have his chair that he sat on that had his snuff and his tobacco. They had his wife's mannequins were dressed up like the wife would have been, or the daughter. The books he read with his little notes in them. And he wrote thousands of letters to his wife because they were separated from one another for a long period of time. When he was in Washington, she stayed in Auburn. So I started getting interested in Seward. And then I thought, well, what about these other guys in the cabinet, Chase and Bates? And then I realized that that was the story I wanted to tell, that he'd put all these people who were his rivals into his cabinet. So it expanded it to a quintuple biography, but it made it so much more fun because they all talked about Lincoln in ways that the normal biographies might not have, because I read their diaries, and I don't know what's going to happen 200 years from now. We'll have much more stuff about us, but not the intimate detail that comes from diaries and from letters. So then the same thing happens. I'm fascinated by Teddy Roosevelt ever since I taught a seminar on him when I was at Harvard 1,000 years ago. And I couldn't just write a biography on him. There'd just been a great 3-volume biography on him. So I found out there were 400 letters between Teddy and Taft. And they were much greater friends than I had known, so that their breakup was much more heartbreaking than I had known. And then I realized the difference between the two was that Teddy was so good with the press, so understanding of the partnership, Taft much more reluctant. And that's where the muckrakers came in, because they'd been Teddy's great friend and they helped his presidency and they hurt Taft. So suddenly that book became 3 books, Teddy, Taft, and the Muckrakers. So someday I dream that I'm just going to find a person who had a life that began at a certain point and ended at a certain point, and then it'll be a short book. I mean, somebody teased me. They wrote me a letter about reading The Bully Pulpit, and it was a very nice letter. This woman said how much she liked it, but she fell asleep reading it at night, and it fell on her nose and broke her nose. So it's up to me to write a shorter book soon.
Are these eureka moments where you think, Seward, let's see, the other cabinet members, maybe I could do a sort of, you know, Lincoln and his cabinet, and then this, I mean, you just get a feeling of, by God, that's it.
Yeah, it almost is that. I mean, because I had struggled the first 2 years of that 10 years realizing that it wasn't going to work for the kind of book I wanted to write, to have it be Abe and Mary. It would be a private book and about a marriage, and that was interesting, but I cared about the public side of his leadership. And so once I saw that these other people were so interesting in their own right, and once I started reading their letters and I realized they were talking about what Lincoln did that day, and they would often talk competitively about it, that the one who didn't like him might say something different he did, and then you have all these sources. And I remember thinking, oh my God, this is what I can do. Yeah. Now, the idea that it became Team of Rivals, I didn't come up with that title right away. It was just writing about these other guys. And then luckily, just by chance, it happened that when Obama appoints Hillary Clinton to be his Secretary of State, as he had appointed Seward, Lincoln had, then Team of Rivals became a word in the common discourse. But that was way earlier, before I understood that.
Now, of course, you've had films made of your work, certainly the great Lincoln book. When you're writing scenes now, are you at all conscious of, well, how would this look? How does this play dramatically? How does this look scenic? Is that something that enters into your calculations?
You know, it's a really good question, and I'm not sure I know. I mean, I think it's true that I knew that Spielberg was going to be doing the movie on Lincoln before I finished the book, because I had met him way back in 1999 when he was doing a documentary on the millennium, and he always had wanted to write a movie about Lincoln. And so he bought an option right then when we met, and I was only half done. So the question, did I think from then on, I certainly hadn't thought about it beforehand, but did I think from then on maybe a little bit? Well, it's not completely true, because Franklin and Eleanor had been bought by Alan Pakula, the great movie director, for a book, and then he was killed in a freak accident.
That's right.
And just now, the person who was the second scriptwriter on Lincoln before Tony Kushner is writing a 10-hour miniseries based on No Ordinary Time for television. So we've had, and my husband had the quiz show movie made.
That's right.
So we were familiar with the world of film, but it's very different because I could see, especially when I worked with Tony Kushner on the script, he's got a different sensibility than I do to think of dialogue, to think of scenes that and physical descriptions of things that I'm not necessarily as able to do, I think, in some ways. But I do think of dramatic moments that could become a scene, especially now because Spielberg's also gotten the rights for Teddy and Taft. So I now, looking back on that book, as I was writing it, and I knew that he was thinking of that all along too, maybe it's in your head, although I think they have capacities that I'm not sure I have. I mean, just watching the movie being made when I was down in Richmond, Virginia, it just seemed miraculous that all these people are doing these things, and it's an enterprise where you're writing alone. That was part of the great fun of the adventure, though, because you do become part of a team when a movie is being made. And this particular team was really close because this movie was so much in Spielberg's heart. And he had so wanted Daniel Day-Lewis to be his Lincoln from the very beginning. So the earlier scripts, which were very good, it was that Daniel hadn't accepted them and had said no until Tony Kushner's script came. So the day that Daniel accepted, Spielberg called me and he asked me, Daniel was living in Ireland at the time, would I take him to Springfield right away to show him the Lincoln sites? And so, of course, I said yes. It was a big burden to take Daniel Day-Lewis to Springfield. And he was supposed to come under an assumed name because they didn't want to announce that he was Lincoln yet, so he could have time to become Lincoln. He has to become this person. So we went to the hotel. I'd arranged with all the people who would take us on the tour the next couple days to the house where Lincoln lived, the State House, to not say anything. You don't know that this is Daniel Day-Lewis. And they were fine about that. But that night, we were supposed to eat in the hotel. And I said to him, so we're just eating in the hotel, right? He said, oh, no, let's go to a bar. So we went to a bar, and immediately somebody bought us drinks. And I thought, oh, my God, it's over. But they didn't recognize him. They recognized me. So it became a huge joke, right? So anyway, we got through the thing, and then he spent a year becoming Lincoln. I sent him stuff on Webster and Clay and Calhoun. But then when I went down to the filming in Richmond, he was no longer Daniel Day-Lewis. I couldn't talk to him. My friend was gone. He was Mr. President or Mr. Lincoln. All the other actors had to call him by that. So I never talked to him during the filming until we went to the awards ceremonies. Or before that, the premiere in L.A. and then New York. So after the New York premiere, he said he wanted to take me to a bar to celebrate our first bar. So he took me to the Carlisle, his bar, and he gave me these old Cuban drinks, his favorite drinks. And I only had two, which is important because he had three, and or four maybe. But anyway, it all comes back to a story later, because when he wins the first series of his awards in New York, Spielberg introduces him and tells how he had rejected the role so many times, finally accepted, and he's talked about beautiful rejection letters that he's written. Daniel gets up there to accept the award, and unaccountably, because there's a Wall Street Journal reporter in the room, he says, "I don't reject everything. When Doris Kearns Goodwin asked me to go binge drinking with her, I accepted it once." And it was in the Wall Street Journal the next day. So anyway, it was a great, and then we went all the way through to the Academy Awards, and I missed it when it was over, because I realized that's the pleasure that people working in a group enterprise have that we don't have as individual writers.
Who's going to play Teddy Roosevelt?
I don't know. You know, I mean, everybody had thought for some reason that there's a possibility of Tom Hanks, who's older. There's a possibility of Leonardo DiCaprio, who's younger. I would never have thought of Leonardo until Wolf of Wall Street, but he had that manic physical energy that right. Teddy Roosevelt has. Mm-hmm. And I'm blanking on the name of the Philip Seymour Hoffman was the one that everybody had thought until, of course, he died. He would have been perfect.
Yeah.
Taft, there's fewer people for. You have to be 350 pounds.
John Goodman.
John Goodman. And he's got a really nice face.
Yeah.
So anyway, that is way beyond my control. I mean, that's the one thing these people know far better than I do.
Yes, yes. Well, let's talk about these presidents as guides to our present for a bit. You know, Aaron Davis. David Miller was on our program last week. He's a historian, a political scientist. He's just written a book about the limits of presidential greatness, and pretty much saying it's over. We're not going to have great presidents, and he says why. And, you know, he reported in the course of the hour that when John F. Kennedy gave his first speech on the Cuban Missile Crisis, excuse me, I think the one announcing the embargo, the blockade, and all that, that the television networks went right back to regular programming. There was no interval. There was, you know, they just went right back, the most important moment of the Cold War, right back to regular programming. And of course, today, if it had been a Democratic president, Fox News would belabor him for the next hours, days, and if it were a Republican president, MSNBC would have at him. Meanwhile, so ships would be getting closer and closer, the confrontation. And of course, that's to say nothing about the myriad of claques, partisan claques on the web. And, it reminded me, thinking about this, of the first line of The Go-Between, that wonderful novel by L.P. Hartley, which was made into a Julie Christie movie a generation ago. And he writes, "The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there." I'm wondering, is the past not prologue anymore? Could any of these presidents, could Lincoln, could T.R., could FDR, tell something useful to Barack Obama, given the world we're in today, where these institutions, the constant media, the both televisual and on the web, is not just sort of robbing him of his greatness, eliminating that possibility, but of his legitimacy? How have we reached the point where these are museum pieces, in other words?
Well, I've got to hope no, or else my whole profession of writing these books about these people in the past is the hope that we can learn from their struggles and their triumphs. And I still think that's true. However, there's a real point to what you're saying. I mean, just take the piece of it that you're talking about. The bully pulpit was the president's platform to mobilize public opinion and educate the country. And Teddy Roosevelt is the first one who defined it, but it was there before him. And things have changed very much technologically from the time when Lincoln was president. He was lucky enough to live in a time when the written word was king. So he would write his speeches, and they would then be printed in full in the newspapers. They would be pamphletized, and everybody would be sent around the pamphlets, and it became part of a common conversation. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he was such a good writer was perfectly attuned to the time for him to be a public educator for the people. And then you get Teddy Roosevelt coming along, and he's perfectly suited for the mass market newspapers, which have now come on the scene rather than the party press of the 19th century. And he's so colorful, and he's got all this great language, you know. He even gave Maxwell House the slogan, good to the very last drop. They said my friend Doug Brinkley claims that he drank 40 cups of coffee a day. That would be a lot, but he does have a lot of energy, so something's right about that. But at any rate, you know, speak softly and carry a big stick, the square deal. He spoke so simply. He understood how to reach the headlines of the newspapers. Then you get up to FDR, the age of radio, and he has the perfect voice for the radio. And like the television example you give of Teddy, JFK, when his radio chats were on, that was what was on the radio. And 80% of the adult radio audience would be listening. Now, he only gave 30 fireside chats in 12 years, knowing that if he spoke too often, he would lose his effectiveness. And that's also part of the problem today when we get up to today. But meanwhile, Saul Bellow said you could walk down the street on a hot Chicago night when one of these radio chats would be on the air, and you could keep walking and not miss a word of what he was saying, because you could look in the houses through the lit windows and everybody was sitting by their living room or in their kitchen listening to the radio. In fact, I found a story the other day where some construction worker was going home early, and the partner said, "Where are you going?" He said, "Well, President Roosevelt's coming to speak to me in my living room. I have to be there to greet him." You know, so there was that sense of intimacy. And then you get up to television, and you're absolutely right. At the time of JFK, and even to Reagan, when all three networks would cover the news, you heard the speech, and then you went back to ordinary programming. So you could absorb the speech itself, and it could become part of your common dialogue. And now what happens exactly as you suggest is you're watching maybe your favorite cable network, you're only hearing a part of the speech, you're hearing the pundits criticize the speech before it's even begun.
Yes.
And then even if it creates a conversation in the next couple days, the facts are different from both sides, and then breaking news comes in and we're fragmented in our attention. I mean, think about Obama tried to use the bully pulpit and specifically talked about using the bully pulpit after the killings in Connecticut on gun control. And he did everything you could do at that time. He brought the people together for dramatic events. He gave speeches. They became public. And before you knew it, our attention had shifted to something else. Yes. And meanwhile, the interests that care about non-gun control are out there permanently. And even now, you think about a month ago we were obsessed with Ukraine, and then it was ISIS, and then it's Ebola. I think it is much harder for a president, because everybody has a bully pulpit today.
Yes.
And even the reporters who would be analyzing the speeches, they are on television, they're on the radio, they're blogging, and their attention span is lessened. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean I still have to believe. Like, I remember when I was on Jon Stewart the first time, and he asked a similar question, could Lincoln possibly become president today? And I was teasing, well, I thought he might have to lose his beard and lose his top hat. But I'd have to believe that our country could still see that kind of quality in a person. That was also the embarrassing time when I was on that show that I said, I actually thought Lincoln was sexy, because there was a picture of him before the beard where he looks really rugged, and he never let me forget. You think Lincoln is sexy? That's the last thing one thought. Well, finally, when Daniel played him in the Lincoln movie, I went back on Jon Stewart. I said, I told you all along he was sexy.
Well, how about this as something he could learn? Al Franken jokes that on the Republican bumper sticker is very simple. No. That's their bumper sticker. The Democratic bumper sticker, it has a lot of words, and then it says, to be continued on the next bumper sticker. you write about the Square Deal, the New Frontier, the Great Society, and I think a couple of years ago, either Clinton or Obama wanted to call their program, quote, the New Foundation, and you quipped that it sounded like ladies' underwear.
Yeah. there used to be, for those of us who are older, foundation garments, which were like big girdles.
Why can't the Democrats just learn this simple lesson?
I think that's a really important lesson. I mean, one of the things Teddy Roosevelt said, he said, I have to talk to the public, not in the way my Harvard buddies might want me to talk, but in folksy, simple language. And I have to repeat over and over again what I'm going to say. So he went out on these whistle-stop tours in the spring and in the fall, and he would get his message, square deal for rich or poor, capitalist or wage worker. I'm not against the rich as long as they don't take advantage of what they are doing. I'm not against the poor as long as they work hard. He had these simple sayings where a good servant in public is the same kind of trustworthy friend. You don't promise what you can't deliver. Mm-hmm. And somehow I think the problem for the Obama presidency began in that summer of after the health care bill was introduced, and it was never explained clearly enough to the American public in simple terms so that the Tea Party got ahead of him, and they explained it in their terms, death panels. They understood the simplicity of something, right, even if it was totally wrong. And all of that led up to those 2010 midterms where he lost the majority, and everything has been changed since then. I mean, it's almost hard now. I mean, even if you could explain the health care bill more fully now, and people are enjoying it and getting much out of it, those initial impressions were never lost. So I think it's even more important in this complicated world we have today to really understand that your communication skills are essential, and they have to be simple, and they have to be repeated, and you have to know that the other side's going to be saying things that aren't true necessarily, and so you have to get back out there. You can't expect that one or two speeches is going to do it.
And isn't it ironic that a man who got to the presidency, at least in part, in large part, through his eloquence, missed that?
It still is surprising. I mean, when you think about Obama on the campaign trail, he was a brilliant campaigner. And I think part of it, interestingly, is that sometimes a public leader needs the feeling of the people to really become the speaker they are. Even FDR, when he did his fireside chats, he couldn't bear just being in a room alone with the microphone in front of him. So he would have people there so he could look at the people and then imagine in his mind the person in the living room or the person in the kitchen. And the teleprompter, I think, is very distancing from the public. And I remember Lyndon Johnson, they used to tease him that when he spoke spontaneously, he was fabulous. He was such a colorful storyteller, but he was always afraid he was going to say something wrong. And I think that's true for all presidents now. They speak from those written words on the teleprompter because they're afraid if they make one misstatement, then the other side, that's going to be the story of the speech. But what you lose from that is the spontaneity. I mean, I think he'd be much better off just talking from talking points and maybe not talking in front of a teleprompter, even when he's talking to us, because some people knew how to do that. Reagan mastered as if he were just talking to us when he did it. But I think it's been a hard tool for him in a certain sense, because then he's back on the campaign trail and he's great all over again.
Yes.
But sitting in that Oval Office, you know, it's really interesting. My husband's been Richard Goodwin, who worked for JFK and LBJ and wrote so many of LBJ's great speeches. I'm so proud we've actually found them all in the originals, and you see his writing. And he said, "What are you so excited about? I always told you I wrote these." I said, "I know, but I'm an historian and I'm seeing it." But anyway, we found this incredible memo that he's in his early 30s, that he writes to JFK in 1962, telling him that he's not speaking well on television because he's treating it too much like the radio, and he's reading from a text. And he said, you're giving too many statistics. It's not simple enough. He said, when we were young and inexperienced, because my husband worked in the campaign, you needed statistics to bolster you, but you don't need them now. Just talk more simply and get rid of that desk in front of you. It distances yourself. Maybe you should sit in your rocking chair. And then to cover himself, he said, "I've checked some of these things out with Edward R. Murrow, and he agrees."
The oracle.
But it's amazing. The same memo could be given to President Obama today.
Today.
That same memo. So,
today. Well, you know, you mentioned your husband, you and he met with candidate Obama, I believe it was, in 2007. And he told you, this is quoting from a New Yorker article, he said to you, "I have no desire to be one of those presidents who are just on the list. You see their pictures on the wall. I really want to be a president who makes a difference." And then you, to the author, which David Remnick, you said to him, there was the sense that he wanted to be big. He didn't want to be Millard Fillmore or Franklin Pierce. Well, where is he on the wall? Where do you think? we're going
yeah,
to...
Yeah. I guess the poor Millard Fillmore always gets used as the example of a president you don't want to be, and I guess it's partly because of his name rather than anything else. But it was interesting. At that time in 07, one day while he was still way behind Hillary, I got a call on my cell phone, and it was, the other person said, "Hello, this is Barack Obama. I've just read Team of Rivals, and we have to talk." And he wasn't talking about putting Hillary in his cabinet. He was way behind. He was so fascinated with Lincoln's emotional intelligence and how he was able to forget people that had hurt him in the past. So I went to the Senate office building, and that's when we talked to him, and this conversation came up. And then once he won the nomination, somebody said to him, and a reporter said to him, "Would you really be willing to put someone into your inner circle, even if his or her spouse had, even if she'd been a big rival, and his or her spouse was an occasional pain in the butt," and obviously referring to Hillary. And then he quoted Lincoln saying, "The country's in peril. I need the strongest, most people. Yes, I will." And then he, of course, put her in. And then after that, I got to know him, and he asked me over these last years, once a year, to put together our fellow historians to give him advice from our guys, actually, so we don't go dressed up as Truman or Jackson or Washington, but it's really been fun. And then you ask the question, where will he fall on this spectrum? And it's really hard to know now. I mean, as an historian, it usually takes a generation, I think, to look back at where a president is. Right now, it looks complicated for him to be in that large spectrum. Things are really difficult. This has got to be, these last couple of years, frustrating for him as well as for all of us. And yet, when I think about Lyndon Johnson, now that it's the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and four presidents went down, and we were there too in Austin to celebrate that. If he had only known that before he was so sadly dying, that his domestic stuff would be appreciated, but it's taken so long because of the war in Vietnam. Yes. But you think about it, you know, the law that desegregated the South, the Voting Rights Act, open housing, Medicare, aid to education, public broadcasting. I mean, he changed the landscape, Elementary and Secondary Education Act, Higher Education Act. He changed the Head Start.
Head Start.
He changed the landscape of our country, and it's taken that long for that to be appreciated. When Truman left, he was way at the bottom of a public opinion polls, and only later did historians recognize. So the question will be, how much will historians look back on what he did with the stimulus? Did it help us get out of what was a really serious recession, second only to the Depression? What about the you know, the Health Care Act, and finally after 100 years we got health care. There'll be difficulties about the Iraq and Afghanistan war, which we had with our previous presidents, and now, however, this ISIS thing turns out. There'll be a sense of wanting more from him because we had such great expectations. And that's what historians will sort out in the future. And I doubt that I'll be around to do that, not 50 years from now.
Has he been preemptively sort of curbing expectations? This Remnick article quotes him as saying, "Look, history is a big process, and we only have each of us a little bit. It's a relay race. You know, I carry it so far, someone else carries it. You just try to get your paragraph right." Somehow I can't hear the grandiose Lyndon Johnson speaking of his ambitions in such modest, maybe realistic, but modest terms. Is the president sort of saying to those historians, "Look, I'm in this world described by Aaron David Miller. You got to adopt a new measure here. It put me up against these great guys, and it's apples and oranges. You can't be great anymore."
I still don't want to believe that, that you can't be great anymore. But it's not a matter of the individual being great. What's made our presidents often the strong ones that we've had are a combination of a movement in society that wells up and gives strength to the president. So the anti-slavery movement was there before Abraham Lincoln. Without that anti-slavery movement, Lincoln would not have been elected, much less a president, would not have had the support behind him to strengthen the Union and eventually go for emancipation. Without the civil rights movement, LBJ could not have done what he did. And without the women's movement, many of us today would not be doing what we're doing, the environmental movement, the gay rights movement. I mean, and that has all happened. Those mm-hmm. social movements have gone on while we're all frustrated about our government in a mm-hmm. certain way. Certainly the enormous progress for gays and lesbians is amazing yes. in these last years. And makes one hopeful again. Mm-hmm. So where mm-hmm. you really get change is when that society is moving forward. And you had it in the progressive era. There were activists out there in the settlement houses. There were activists in the churches, in the synagogues, who knew that they had to get government to soften the industrial order somehow. And Teddy Roosevelt and the press and these activists worked together to do it. Mm-hmm. That's why the moment in LBJ's We Shall Overcome speech that is the most powerful moment is when he's calling for the Voting Rights Act and he calls on the anthem of the civil rights movement and he says, "We shall overcome." That meant that he was allying himself with the movement mm-hmm. and that's when change comes. So if we're going to have great presidents in the future, it's partly dependent on us.
On us.
Because, I mean, all of us know one thing, and I bet many of you would agree here, money is the poison in the system today. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely mm-hmm. destroying our government. Mm-hmm. And we know it, right? Mm-hmm. And if I were young, I mean, when I think about what's wrong with the government and why maybe we're not getting anything done, how much time are our congressmen and senators spending worrying about where they're getting their funds from? What interest groups do they have to cater to? Putting those dumb ads on television. I mean, a friend of ours from Britain was here the other day. He couldn't believe how many political ads were. I didn't even realize they don't have those kind of things everywhere. I just think it's poisoned the whole world. And there are constitutional amendments that could be had. FDR once said, human problems are created by men. They can be solved by men. Mm-hmm. And we've lost that feeling that we can do anything about this. It's like the structure of our system. We know that redistricting is all screwed up, but you can change that. And some states are changing it, having nonpartisan mm-hmm. districting commissions. We know the money is a problem when we make these campaign finance laws that are too little and too much, and then the Supreme Court comes. Mm-hmm. If I were young, I'd be leading a crusade on that. But more importantly, it means the guy in the bully pulpit, McClure, who ran the magazine where Ida Tarbell and Ray Baker and all these great people were, in the end, he said, in the end, it's us, the public. Mm. We have to do it. And that's what I worry about as much as whether we have a great leader in there. We are so fragmented in our attention. Yes. I mean, in the 19th century, politics was the central entertainment sports value. You know, people would go to listen to Lincoln give four-hour debates, and there would be 10,000 people there. You didn't have the professional sports. You didn't have Hollywood. You didn't have movies. You had politics, and people would be on the street corner, and they would be giving a talk, and everybody was listening. And now it's not even our entertainment. If it is anything, it's our entertainment, because we look into their private lives, and we laugh about the foibles they have. It's an unhealthy situation we're in right now, but the solace I get as a historian is it's not as bad as the 1850s when, you know, they were carrying revolvers on the Senate floor and when they, you know, the senator from Massachusetts was hit over the head with a cane and when the Civil War broke out. But it for the last 50 years, I mean, it used to be like in LBJ's time that they didn't run home on the weekends to raise funds. They stayed in Washington. Mm-hmm. Republicans and Democrats formed friendships across party lines. They played poker. They drank together. So when LBJ had to go to Dirksen to get the Republican minority leader to get the Republicans to help break the filibuster on civil rights, they were friends. He knew it. And he could also promise him everything under the sun that now would be so transparent it would be horrible.
Corruption.
A little bit of corruption for a good end.
Yes.
So,
yes.
I mean, he promised him public works, projects, dams, whatever he needed. But then he also knew Dirksen. So he said, Everett, I know you care about history too. And if you come with me on this bill, 200 years from now, school children will know only two names, Abraham Lincoln and Everett Dirksen. But, you know, 50 years ago, too, a lot of those people who were in Congress and the Senate had been in World War II together, maybe the Korean War. They knew what it meant to have a common mission where you don't care about where you come from or what party you're in.
Right.
And all of that has changed.
I think I have a scene when the Marines were killed in the barracks in Lebanon, 1983. President Reagan had a session at the White House. Sitting next to him was Tip O'Neill, his inveterate enemy. While the president began to speak, O'Neill put one of those hands, which were as big as hams, on top of Reagan's hand and just kept it there while the president spoke. you know, unthinkable today.
Right.
He was saying, "I'm with you, brother."
Right. Exactly.
Look, let's hear from folks in the audience here. I'm sure there are all kinds of questions from your fans. So just come up to the microphone. There's a microphone here, and there's one at the back. Is there? Yep. And there's one. Is there one over here?
No, there are two. One here and one further
okay.
back down the aisle. We'll alternate.
Okay, all right, very good. Yes, sir.
I was wondering, by the way, this has been fascinating, how you think the presidency of President Obama will in any way affect the future opportunity for African-American people to run and to succeed in American political life?
Mm. Oh, it's such an important question. I mean, the great moment when Obama won the presidency in 2008 seemed like a great moment in American history, not only for African Americans, but I think for white America and for all of America to know that we had gone through something and that seemed past us, just like the first Catholic president when JFK got elected. I don't know. I mean, I think there is definitely a racial element to the backlash against President Obama. It's certainly not the only thing that's happened, but it's there. And it's come out more forcefully in these last years than certainly we thought it would in 2008. Will that affect other African Americans, as your question suggests, running for office? I don't know. I mean, everybody who runs is such an individual, and at least we look at them that way. And there are more African Americans at all levels of our politics now, so there's more to choose from, just like more women finally to choose from. So hopefully, we would judge them. They will. I think the question is, would it make an African American know I'm going to have to go through more than I thought I might have had to because he's seen or she's seen what's happened to Obama? But hopefully, if that person is a public figure and has those ambitions and desires to be a public servant, then they just get over that and they'll still go to whatever level they wanted to try to reach. Hmm. But it's a very thoughtful question.
Yes. Yes.
Hi, my name is Donna. I just wanted to ask if you had ever seen the play All the Way about LBJ and the Civil Rights Act, and if so, what your thoughts about it were.
I thought the play LBJ was fantastic.
Yeah, Bryan Cranston.
Oh my God, Bryan Cranston was LBJ. Yeah. So he came, we met him before the play in Cambridge. He came to our house and we had dinner with him and we showed him all my husband's papers and we talked to him for hours about LBJ and then we went down to the premiere in New York. And what he captured about LBJ was just that physical, mental energy and the love of the guys in the Congress. I mean, that's still something that could happen today. I mean, when LBJ, despite how difficult those people are in the Congress, and despite the fact they only want to vote no, it still matters if you have them over to the White House. And Johnson, from the time JFK was assassinated, in the next 6 months, he had groups of congressmen over. Every week or so, 30 would come. And he'd have them to dinner, they would dance, he's terrible. He would say, "I would dance with the ugliest wives." I mean, that's not the most lovely thing to say. And then afterwards, he'd go into the cigar room with the guys, and then Lady Bird would take them on a tour of the White House. He would call those, and just as you saw in the All the Way play, he was on the phone all the time, which was the motif of the play. He would call the congressman at 6 in the morning, he'd call them at noon, he'd call them at dinner. There was even one time he called a senator at 2 a.m. and he said, "I hope I haven't awakened you." He said, "No, I was just lying here looking at the ceiling hoping my president would call." If he didn't get the congressman, he'd talk to the wife. If he didn't get the wife, he'd talk to the daughter. "Now you tell your daddy to go along with me on that bill." And I've still got to believe, as difficult as it has been for Republicans to even want to go to the White House some of the times, and they've refused invitations some of the times.
Even to see Lincoln.
Even to see Lincoln, that's right. A couple of them were invited to see the Lincoln movie, and they just didn't want to be seen at the White House. I mean, that's because that's bad for their constituencies. That is a really bad impasse that we've come to. But I still think another president gets in there, I would still give him the LBJ advice, which is love those guys as much as you love your wife. It's almost incest. Have them over as much as you can because they have to be able to show except in these weird times where you don't want to show a picture of yourself in the White House, their constituencies have to know he's close, he's at least seen that guy. And too many of them have not been to the White House in these last years, too many functions, and you need to have that. And that's what I think they can learn from LBJ and from All the Way. It's going to be made a movie as well on television. Wonderful. And it was just miraculous. I mean, I felt like this LBJ that I knew, even better, the LBJ that I imagined in 64 and 65, because I only knew him in those last sadder years, but I saw pieces of that crazy LBJ in the time I knew him. He was alive. He was back there on the stage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, right. Back here.
Yeah. Hi, a nitty-gritty question. When I read a great biography like Team of Rivals, I think, how is it possible in one lifetime to have done all this research and figure out how to put it all together in such a beautiful way?
Oh, thank you so much for that question. I mean, I think the thing that I care about most is storytelling. So the way it's structured really matters, because the truth is, once you are dealing with so many different pieces, when you create these large stories like Team of Rivals or Teddy and Taft or Franklin and Eleanor, the hardest thing is, how do you weave them together without losing the narrative structure? And I think ever since I've been a little kid, it's not like I feel like I'm a great line writer. I mean, I don't think I could write a sentence that would ever rival the sentences my husband can write, for example. What I have confidence in is telling a story. And maybe it comes, as so many of you know, from my having told my father the story of the Brooklyn Dodger game when he came home from work every night. So I had to figure out how to make it dramatic from my miniaturized symbols after he taught me how to keep score. And at first, I didn't know how to do it, and I would blurt out, "The Dodgers won or the Dodgers lost," which took much of the drama of this two-hour telling away. So I learned you had to tell a story from beginning to middle to end. And much later read an essay by my heroine, Barbara Tuchman, who said, even if you're writing about a war, as a storyteller, historian, you have to only tell your reader what you know. Don't let them know you know how the war ended, even if it's World War II. So you only know what the people at the time knew. So I always write chronologically. I mean, it may start somewhere different. I start in Lincoln with those four guys waiting for the news they got the Republican nomination. I start with Teddy and Taft in 1910 when Teddy's coming back from Africa. But then basically it's chronologically, because life occurs chronologically. And so that helps to give me a spine to know how to do it. And it also helps because I start my original research from the letters and the diaries and the newspapers and everything in the memoirs. And I don't have to get it all done before I start writing. Because another thing that Barbara Tuchman once said that I took to heart, I think because she was such a famous woman historian when I was in college, she became a heroine for me, never having met her at that time. But she said, you can't do too much research before you start writing or you'll get paralyzed. And that's probably true. So at least because I'm writing chronologically, if I get enough research done for, you know, like the childhoods of these people or their young adulthoods, I can start writing those chapters and then keep going along the way, or else I would get nervous. But I have huge files, huge numbers of boxes, and it's made it easier finally having a computer because that wasn't true in the early days. So things were handwritten and you had boxes of material, and now you've got files on a computer. But it is the great challenge and the great pleasure for me to figure out how to put these little pieces of research together to form a continuing story. So thank you.
Yes, yes.
I just wanted to know, as an historian, what do you define as history versus contemporary modern times? So if you're going to write your next book, what is history versus modern times?
Wow. I mean, I think that, you know, I suppose modern times is history for somebody who's writing about today with a broad perspective on looking from the outside in at our time. I mean, a lot of journalists now have become really first-rate historians because I think they know, first of all, they know how to write quicker than I do. So they can write about a modern time, but it is an historical perspective. Even on the first term of Obama, that can be history. The difference is that it does take time sometimes for the judgment of that time to gel. So when you're writing that first draft of today, you may be getting more stuff in there that then another historian is going to use 30 years later, and they may have a different perspective on it because time has passed by. But I mean, when I was telling my father those stories of the Brooklyn Dodger game, I thought it was history and it was only 4 hours old. So that was the key to the whole thing. For me, I would have a hard time writing about President Obama, for example, because I need the letters and the diaries. That's my favorite source. And I don't, as I said before, we're going to have much more stuff about our current presidents. We'll know how they walked and talked. We had no idea other than that somebody said that Lincoln had a high-pitched voice. So when they decided Daniel Day Lewis would have a high-pitched voice, it was because it had been recorded by somebody, not the voice, but the fact that he had a high-pitched voice. We knew he walked like a laborer coming home at the end of a hard day because somebody said that. So that's the way he could walk. Now people will see us walking and talking. But the intimate knowledge you get when I used to go over the shoulder of a handwritten letter that somebody wrote in the end of the Civil War day, I felt like I knew those people as a result. And I couldn't feel that from everything today. So I have to go back further in time. But some modern historians will be writing about yesterday as if it's history, and that's okay.
Famously, at Harvard for years, an eminent historian whom I will not identify vetoed the idea of a 20th century historian. He said that we do not give a chair to journalism.
Wow.
To history. That was his.
I'm glad.
Yes.
I'm glad I didn't know that guy.
Yeah. Hi, Doris. I'm Hal Lyon, and I first met you when you were a White House fellow.
Whoa.
And you were then Doris Kearns. And the word going around among those of us in the administration was that you were the first woman White House fellow, and that LBJ wanted you in the White House with him. And then, shortly before you came, an article you published with the title something like, "Let's Dump Lyndon in the Next Election," came out, and LBJ was furious, as I understand it, and he said, "Send her to Willard Wirtz over at the Department of Labor. I don't want that blankety-blank woman here." Now, you went to Willard Wirtz, as I understand it, but then the president met you, and you started to kind of visit him often, and then you became his confessor, and I'm not sure if you told me this, or kind of his psychotherapist. And he cried with you about the boys dying in Vietnam, and is that the true story?
It is almost the true story, yes. In fact, what happened is I was chosen as a White House fellow, and we did have a dance at the White House the night we were selected. He did dance with me, not that peculiar. There were three women in our 16 White House fellows class, and he did say to me he wanted me to work directly for him in the White House. But prior to my selection as a White House fellow, I'd been active in the anti-Vietnam War movement while I was a graduate student at Harvard, and had written an article with a friend of mine, which came out in the New Republic 2 days after the dance in the White House. And the title of the article was "How to Remove Lyndon Johnson from Power." So I was certain he would kick me out of the entire program. But surprisingly, he said, "Oh, bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can." But nobody wanted me to go to the White House right away. I seemed like a rather unconventional, not to be trusted person. Willard Wirtz agreed to take me in the Labor Department. He became, I loved him. He was a wonderful man. And then what happened is in 1968, when Johnson withdrew from the race, I had seen him at the White House several times. We White House fellows would go over there, and he would always point his finger at me and say, "You ask me a question." And so everything was seemingly okay. But anyway, after he withdrew from the race, the next day he called up Willard Wirtz, and he said, "I want her to come over here now. She said I should be removed. I've removed myself. Now she owes it to me to work for me." So then I left Willard Wirtz, and I went to work with him. And it really was an extraordinary experience. I mean, he would, at the end of the day, oftentimes, I was working on Labor Department problems still in the White House, manpower problems in the day, but at night he just wanted to talk to somebody. And I'd go and listen to him talk, and then that ended up staying with him the last 6 months of his White House experience, and then staying and helping him on his memoirs while I was still beginning to teach at Harvard. And I, as I said before, I mean, if I'd known him at the height of his power, he never would have had the time to talk to me the way he did. I mean, I think part of his attraction to me was that I loved listening to his stories, and he was a great storyteller, even though half of his stories weren't true, I finally discovered. I'll never forget one time I was swimming with him in his pool. He had this amazing pool at the ranch that was filled with objects so that he could keep working while he was swimming. So there were rafts with telephones on them, rafts with notepads, and you couldn't maneuver yourself in the pool, but he really just wanted to stand there. Anyway, he was still president. We were standing in the pool, and he had given a speech the day before to the troops going to Vietnam, in which he mentioned that his great-great-grandfather had died at the Battle of the Alamo. Very stirring speech. But a reporter that morning had said it might have been a good speech, except he didn't have a great-great-grandfather who died at the Alamo. He just must have wanted to so much he made him up. So I turned to President Johnson in the pool and I said, "How can you do that?" And he looks at me and he says, "Oh, these journalists, they're such sticklers for detail." So anyway, I think part of his attraction for me was that I loved listening to his tall tales. But I also worried that part of it was that I was then a young woman and he had somewhat of a minor league womanizing reputation. So I was constantly chattering to him about steady boyfriends, even when I had none at all. And everything was working perfectly until one day he said he wanted to discuss our relationship, which sounded ominous, when he took me nearby to the lake, conveniently called Lake Lyndon Johnson. And there was wine and cheese and a red check tablecloth, all the romantic trappings. And he started out, "Doris, more than any other woman I have ever known." And my heart sank. And then he said, "You remind me of my mother." It was embarrassing what was going on in my mind.
Congratulations to you for your great writing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
So I just want a quick announcement. I know there are a bunch of questions, but we do only have 5 minutes left. We'll take two more questions, one from each microphone. And just a reminder, Doris will be signing after the event. So two more, one here.
And where is Doris going to be signing?
Just outside the entrance in the main tent.
Out here?
Yep.
Yep. All right. Yep. Thank you. Yes, please.
Hi. I'm wondering, you've just got such an incredible grasp on leadership and all of these powerful men, and we're certainly on the precipice of women starting to have more of a voice as we look forward internationally and perhaps domestically in the near future, but certainly even in the Senate with Warren and Gillibrand and other women. So I just wonder, with all of the kind of the incredible understanding you have of a portrait of leadership and what it takes for these incredible men to get there, what your feelings are, and maybe even as a woman studying these, what that means for looking forward to women starting to take on these positions.
Oh, I mean, it's something I think about a lot, actually, because I think my next book is going to be, rather than a new person, it's going to be on leadership. I want to figure out, looking at the people I've already studied, what are the attributes they shared? How did they stay close to their constituencies? How did they communicate? How did they acknowledge error? All the things we know that leaders do. And Eleanor Roosevelt is definitely going to be in that book. And what's interesting to me when I look at it, because I haven't done this before with her, how did her leadership shift from when she was the wife of a president and got her power through him? Mm-hmm. Even then, she was the most powerful first lady, the first lady ever to speak at a national convention, to hold weekly press conferences where she made a simple rule that only female reporters could cover her press conferences, so stuffy publishers had to hire their first female reporters. A whole generation got their job because of Eleanor Roosevelt. And then he dies, and then she becomes a figure in her own right, and she becomes a public leader. And I haven't looked at it that way, but I want to see how different that was for her than the UN Declaration of Human Rights and how she maneuvered that. And hoping that that will be maybe like the last chapter in this book as a forerunner to the fact of, I had a lunch the other day with somebody who is the dean of the Harvard Business School, a wonderful guy. We were talking about the difference in female and male leadership, and I've been reading some books about it right now, and I don't know the answer yet, but I do know that one thing has got to be certain, that as more women are going to college now than men, more women are going to medical school, more women are going to law school, women are there, and we are coming. And the time has come for women leaders. In fact, you know, when I think about it, of all the movements, and obviously civil rights movement, the gay rights movement, the women's movement has probably changed more people's lives than any other movement, because you think about the fact that even in my time, when I grew up, nobody on my block, none of the mothers worked. Now, to some extent, it was great for us kids, so I understand that. But on the other hand, all the talents that those women might have had that were never able to be expressed, and now women have talents, they can express them, they can be friends with men, they get married, and the men are helping with the kids. kids as well as, it's still not as 50-50, but it's a huge change in the relationships of all of us, men and women, to each other, and change with families, some for good, some for bad. So it'll be about time that leadership catches up with this huge social change that has taken place in our country.
Here, here. Yes, and one more question. Do we have time for one more?
Thank you both for a real treat of an interview. I was just reflecting on the fact that so much of political success is also an international affair, and wondering who your political heroes are outside the U.S., and whether you'd ever consider a biography that actually crossed borders.
Well, I would have given anything, I think, to have written about Winston Churchill. I don't think there's, I guess maybe it's partly because I would need the language if I were going to write about somebody else, and I'm not good with languages. I had 8 years of French, and I still, when I go to Paris, can't speak French. I had 2 years of Russian. That's not going to help me very much if I tried to do something of some Russian leader. But English I could speak and read. And if there hadn't been William Manchester's great biographies on Winston Churchill, there's no international figure that I would love to have written about more. I mean, just the idea that this man could have that communication skill, could be down in the valley of despair at one point in his life, come up at the right time in World War II, drink all day long, smoke cigars all day long, and still live till 90 and still live a public life. I mean, I'll just maybe end, as we're thinking about Churchill, which my favorite story in World War II, which is that Churchill came to visit Roosevelt right after Pearl Harbor, and they were set to sign a document putting the Associated Nations against the Allied powers. And Churchill was staying in a room on the second floor diagonally across from Roosevelt's. And early that morning, nobody liked the word Associated Nations, so Roosevelt awakened with a whole new idea of calling the Allied nations the United Nations. He was so excited he hadn't sort of wheeled into Churchill's bedroom to tell him the news. But it so happened that Churchill was just coming out of the bathtub and had absolutely nothing on. So Roosevelt said, "I'm so sorry, I'll come back in a few moments." Churchill, ever able to speak in a very formal voice, said, "Oh no, still dripping from the tub, nothing on, please stay. The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States." So, how can you not want to write about that kind of man?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was wonderful.
Thank you.
That was just wonderful.